I'm Mark Feinsand, executive reporter for MLB.com. Welcome to Season 3 of the Executive Access Podcast. Billy Beane started his baseball career as a player in the Mets organization, but his playing career stalled out after 6 years and only 148 games with the Mets, Twins, Tigers, and Athletics. He began his front office career immediately after his playing days were over, remaining with Oakland as an advanced scout. 30 years later, Beane is still with the Athletics in his third decade running the club's baseball operations department. I sat down with Beane in his office this spring to discuss his career, the book and subsequent movie that made him a household name, no, I didn't bring up Brad Pitt, and how the game has changed most since he first broke into it. This is a guest I've wanted to have on here since we started this podcast, and I'm thrilled to finally have him on. Enjoy this conversation with Athletics Executive Vice President of Baseball Operations, Billy Beane. Billy, you grew up in San Diego, played three sports in high school. Was baseball always the first love?
I think so, but my love was what I was playing at the time too. I remember at times, you know, what I liked about growing up in that era is it wasn't really the age of specialization. So, during basketball season, I loved playing basketball. Actually, for a long time, basketball was probably the one I enjoyed playing the most, and I probably is the one I played more during the summer. But my favorite was usually the one that was going on at that time. And even during the summer, great thing about San Diego, during the summer, we spent playing other sports. I mean, we played tennis, and we used to sell golf balls and to the golfers that would hit them out when I lived in Pacific Beach. And then when I moved up to Rancho Bernardo, we would actually plug golf balls out of the driving range. They give us free golf holes at the golf course. So we got to do a little bit of everything there, which was nice. But again, for me, it was baseball is the one I think that bonded me with my father, because you know he was the one who taught me baseball. A lot of the other ones we played a lot of a catch with a football around too, but basketball is when I literally learned myself and taught myself how to play. But baseball is the one that my father and I had the relationship over.
You were being recruited to Stanford to play football. You ended up signing with the Mets out of high school. Was that a difficult decision?
Well, the difficult decision was not going to Stanford, mainly because, you know, for my parents, my father was a military man, and sports was really an avenue to a scholarship. I mean, my parents, you know, we weren't wealthy by any means. We were certainly very, as you would expect, a military middle class. And so sports was just an opportunity to get into a great university. And so the disappointment came, I think, and looking back, if I have one regret in life, it was not going to school, mainly because of the experience of Stanford, especially sit here in today's world, when you think of the impact Stanford's had on the entire world. So missing that opportunity is something that, again, that's probably the one regret I have. But it was a tough decision. And in fact, the decision to sign really came about when the Mets actually offered me the opportunity to sign professionally at a high school and still attend Stanford at the same time, which was kind of a got my cake and eat it too. And so when I signed under that agreement. What ended up happening was a week in 1980, a week before I was getting ready to go to freshman orientation, I was playing in Little Falls, New York, in the New York Penn League. I got a letter from the Dean of Admissions, and he said, listen, if you're going to go to Stanford as a part-time student, you have to go full term your freshman year. And at that time, I had told the Mets I would go to two quarters at Stanford and then miss the third quarter. But Stanford, like I said, right at the very end, said, you know, you can't do that. You need to go full term all the way through June, your freshman. Then you can become a part-time student. And at that point, I had told the Mets, and I felt like I owed it to them to, you know, live up to my end of the agreement. So that's how it turned out.
You ended up studying economics at UC San Diego. You did that in your off seasons?
I did, until then I started getting called to the major leagues with the Mets, and, you know, September was when the quarter would start there, so I was unable to once I started getting called to the big leagues, I wasn't able to go back. But yeah, my first couple off seasons went to UC San Diego.
Was there economics? Was there a thought in your head of if baseball doesn't work out, a business background's probably not the worst thing, or why economics?
I think when I had started, that was the only business degree, I believe, at that time at UCSD. Econ was it was the same with Stanford. I remember when I was going to go to Stanford, back in 1970, business sounded like, oh, I'll do business. But econ, I think, was the only business degree at the time, and I think that's why I'm not sure I was particularly interested at that time in economics. I think I was just more interested in pursuing a business degree.
You wound up playing parts of six seasons with the Mets, Twins, A's, and Tigers. And a lot of those seasons at bats in the big leagues were kind of few and far between.
when you finally decided to stop playing, what sort of pushed you towards that?
You know, I loved playing, but my dream was really to do what I'm doing now, to be honest with you. In some sense, I saw playing as an avenue to doing what I'm doing, which is running a baseball team. So, you know, I played 10 years professionally, as you said, parts of six in the major leagues. My first daughter was due in May. You know, at the time I was going up and down each year was sort of, you know, try and make a team, and it just seemed very tenuous. I was looking to do something that I really anticipated doing the rest of my life, and I was in the outfield shagging balls. There was a lot of dead time playing that really kind of drove me crazy. There was times I'd sit out in the outfield shagging or getting leads off second, and I was going, that was just, to be totally honest, bored out of my skull. And it was in 1990, and Ron Shuler was the advanced scout, and I loved the evaluation part of the game. I loved watching the game. I loved I used to sort of pick Sandy Alderson's brain when he was the general manager there about, you know, we talked to him about players and things like that, even when I was a player. And so when Ron Shuler, we were in the outfield one day shagging in spring training, it was close to this time of year exactly, and he said he was looking for a new advanced scout because they're going to have him do some other things. And I kind of looked at him and I said, you know, I'd be interested in doing that. And I was like 27 actually. And he goes, he said, well, don't you want to play a few more years? And I said, no, I'd really like to do that. It's ultimately something that I'd want to do. And he goes, well, I'll talk to Tony La Russa and Sandy. So the next day, you know, they called me in. They said, are you serious? Are you sure you want to stop playing? And I said, yeah. And I took the job. In fact, I remember Walt Weiss. One day I'm stretching the day before, and then the next day I'm walking in my uniform to the coaches. We used to use the other clubhouse for coaches meetings back then. And I'm walking. I passed Walt right past the stretching group, and he looked at me like, where are you going? And I said, I'm done. And he goes, what? And literally from that day on, I never looked back. And it was the right time. It was a great decision. And I from that point on, I was really truly doing what I wanted to do.
You held that advanced scouting role through 1993. You were promoted to assistant GM. Your primary responsibility at that point was scouting minor league players. You had been a player, but not a scout. Actually scouting. Is there a specific skill set that you think makes for a better scout, or is that something that you spend enough time doing it, you learn it?
Listen, I think, well, first and foremost, it sounds obvious, but you got to really like watching baseball games. And I enjoyed watching baseball games, and I liked the evaluation of players. Even when I was a player, you pointed out, I mean, I played with some great teams, or at least I sat and watched some great teams from the bench. You know, the Twins in 87, I was with the 89 A's, I was with the Mets when they first started their run when I first came up. So I was around a lot of great players. And I got to observe a lot as a part-time player. And so the advantage I had is that going directly from the playing field, in fact, I did that when I first started, almost all major league scouting. That was all I was doing. It was really easy because I knew the players, and a lot of the players who were coming up from AAA I had known and played against as well. So I think it gave me an advantage, to be honest with you. It was a very, very easy transition. It was literally like 3.5 years that I did that job where I would do the advance work prepping for the series before. And then at the end of the year, I was also, because I'd seen so many players, was responsible for writing up the whole league, the American League. So it was, you know, basically a major league scouting job. And again, I had a passion for wanting to put together a team, and part of that is evaluating players. So for me, it was a dream job. I remember when I got, I used to pinch myself. I wasn't making a lot of money. I mean, going from a major league salary to an advanced scout, in fact, I'll be honest with you, the first year I was an advanced scout in 1990, I believe my salary was $30,000, which it wasn't a lot, it's not a lot of money now, it wasn't a lot of money then.
Right.
But I couldn't have been happier. I loved what I was doing. It was a dream job to be able to go to stadiums and, so I got to know writers, the days when you sit in the press room, I don't know if guys even do that anymore. You know, that's why I got to, I remember Peter Gammons, getting to meet, Hall of Famer Peter Gammons and watching him and then getting to know him and talk to him before a game. And then you'd have the game. And I enjoyed going home and riding up in the hotel and stuff. So for me, it was a dream job. And it lasted exactly probably the amount of time it should have. And then halfway through that season, It was one of the first years we weren't competitive in 93 with the A's. And I remember they sort of said, hey, listen, we're not going to do the advancing. Why don't you go home for a couple of weeks? We're going to figure out, kind of reevaluate how we, you know, do the scouting this year, because we obviously weren't going to win it that year, win the division. And it was probably maybe a month later after that that Sandy called me and offered me the assistant GM job, which was a huge jump. I mean, to go from, you know, being a major league scout to assistant GM was a very big jump. And I was very young, but I was very lucky because I had a lot of support of the people in the organization who'd worked around me those 3.5 years. As you know, well, they know me as a player in 89 in the 3.5 years, and really supported me. Guys like Carl Keel, Tony La Russa, Dave Duncan, who I'd worked with on the major league staff. You know, Sandy was the general manager. So that was really the biggest jump and the biggest break I think I had when I got to, you know, literally go from scouting to being right next to the guy who was making the decisions and one of the best in the game in Sandy Alderson.
In the mid-90s, ownership ordered Sandy to slash payroll, and they started trying to identify undervalued players using a lot of sabermetrics. What was Sandy's biggest influence on you in those early years?
Well, I'll tell you a quick story about that, too. In 93, so that was the year, at the very end of the year, so I was scanning the first half of the year. I wasn't officially named until later in the summer, I think. So I moved up to Oakland that fall from San Diego, and we had a really bad team. And I remember sitting in the suite watching like the last series of the year. I think we ended up losing like 97 games that year. I think we had the worst record in baseball. But back then, if you remember, the worst record in baseball didn't automatically get the first pick. It alternated. So we achieved the worst record, but only got the second pick. So anyway, another story. I remember sitting there watching the last series of the year, and we were awful. And we had a terrible minor league system. We had nothing. And we had a high payroll. We literally had the trifecta that you don't want. Right. High payroll, bad team, no farm system. And we were coming off a really good run. We had tried to extend, you know, a great period in the late 80s and 90s, but we exhausted it. And so I remember thinking, I'm going to get fired in 6 months. This team, and we're so bad right now that I didn't think I was going to – I thought, like, don't buy a house. It's, you know – and so that's how I sort of, you know, entered into the front office with concerns about how long I was actually going to have this job. But as you talk about Sandy now, listen, as soon, you know, it's funny. In fact, even, you know, Michael Lewis wrote in the book, and it's actually true. You know, of all the years I played the game, I played with some Hall of Fame players and, you know, some amazing guys and some amazing talents. But I think the guy that I probably, you know, idolized more than anybody was Sandy. I mean, to me, this was such a unique individual, you know, so bright, and his background was so different than anybody else in baseball, period. I mean, similar to my father in a sense, he was a military officer, but unlike my father and unlike very many other people, he was a Dartmouth undergrad, a Harvard Law School graduate. Come to find out later, when he went to officer candidate, OCS, I believe it, in Quantico, he was the first Marine, I believe, to finish first in classroom training and field training, which I don't think at that time it ever happened. He never told me that, his father did. So I got to be around this amazingly transformational executive, really, when you think about it. A guy who, you know, most of the guys who were running baseball teams were not guys like Sandy. But to be around somebody like that on a daily basis was just, I mean, amazing. And I said this even when when I was named the GM in 98, was my first year, and he actually went to the commissioner's office in 99. I remember, you know, it was really a heartbreaking day because I really felt like working next to a guy like Sandy, I could have done it for my entire career and never been bored. There's never a day that I walked in frustrated that the guy above me, you know, was not smarter than I was. He was smarter than I was. And every day we were friends, you know, I admired what he did. Every day was a learning opportunity, not just from a business standpoint, but from an ethical, from a moral standpoint, just he covered everything. And so that's one of the things, in fact, I tell people now, one of the things I think if people have had success, there's always probably a mentor somewhere in their life, whether it be their father at a young age, in my case, it was my father, and then to be able to professionally to work next to a guy like Sandy, I don't think, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here today if I didn't have somebody like that, a mentor like that, that I could look to and learn from. And so, but Sandy was, he sat down the first day I came to the office, he threw a book on my desk, and it was a negotiation book. And he just said, hey, listen, you played the game 10 years. Now you got to learn the other side of the business, because it was critical for us at that point, as you mentioned, given that our payroll was going from the highest to basically the lowest, that it was critical that we understood the business part of the game and not just the baseball side, or at least I did. And he emphasized to me, it's like, listen, you know, this is what you need to learn, because to run this club going forward, you're going to need to know where every penny's going. And it's going to be a much different game than it was in the 80s for us. And so that was the first day he literally did throw a book on my desk. And then the other thing, too, is he was the one who exposed me to the Bill James and some of the, you know, objective decision makers that were writing about baseball at the time. That, hey, there's a, you know, statistical, mathematical, a quantitative way to put together a baseball team. And it made sense to me. And again, being around Sandy on a daily basis, and somebody who, you know, eventually we thought very much alike. There were two things we did disagree on later on, but it was more. But by and large, we had the basic philosophy was the same.
So when you're named GM after the '97 season, those are pretty big shoes to fill. Did you feel you were ready to sit in that chair?
Yes, but I also felt a sense of comfort knowing that Sandy was there as the president. You know, it was comforting knowing that you know, he gave me a lot of autonomy with the GM role, but it was nice in your first year knowing you had that mentor still around. What was really, I wouldn't say scary, it was exciting and I was a little concerned was when he did leave. You know, it was kind of like that Tom Cruise movie when the, you know, was a risky business. It was like, you know, and it was also, you know, it was also time for us to grow, because, you know, Sandy was gone and he'd sort of been there for a lot of us who are actually still here today, or people who went on to run their own teams, guys like J.P. Ricciardi. And, you know, we now had the keys to the car. And I brought in Paul DePodesta, and you know, it was also an exciting time of growth as well.
It's funny that you mentioned J.P. and Paul. In 1999, you told our friend Howard Bryant, quote, "What I want is to be the baseball equivalent of Bill Walsh, where you have a tree of guys who worked for you the same way I worked for Sandy, running teams all over the league. That to me is pretty cool." When you saw JP go to take Toronto and Paul go run the Dodgers and then Farhan go run the Dodgers, how rewarding was it for you to see guys who were coming up under you to then go on and do exactly what you had talked about?
Yeah, the thing that I think I'm most proud of and most excited about is when guys who have worked with me or worked next to me go on to run their own baseball teams. And in Paul's case, he's also part of a football team now too. So that's the one, again, I make no bones about it. If there's one thing I have an ego about, is that. That's what I'm proud of. And I Farhan, you know, God, what a great story. Grad student, basically a PhD candidate, excuse me, which, and to see what he's doing now, you know, what Paul's done, what JP's done, even Grady Fuson, you know, going on and, to have guys work under myself and then go on to, you know, bigger and better things, that is something I'm very, very proud of. And even David Forrest, who I've been lucky enough, who's the one guy who stayed here, it's been 20 years now, and he's a guy that's turned down many of opportunities to run his own club. And so, again, that's the thing I'm very, very proud of.
You mentioned Paul going to football.
Yeah.
Did you ever think at any point about taking your talents to another sport and giving that a try?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I still do.
let's break some news here.
Yeah,
come on, Billy.
It is. I mean, you know, one of the things I've been very lucky, and that's a credit to the people I've worked for, is that they've given me the opportunity to do a lot of things beyond just doing this job. A, the people around me allow me to do that as well, because I've got such a competent staff that works with me, but also the ownership has given me the opportunity, you know, in fact, you know, it was part of my contract negotiations and, you know, being part of board of directors, you know, I've involved in other sports, partial ownership and in boards and some European soccer/football teams. And so, yeah, I've always been a little bit intellectually restless, and that sort of satisfies it.
5 years after you became the GM, the Red Sox famously pursued you for their GM job, which you accepted before deciding to stay in Oakland. Was there ever a time after that thing settled itself where you thought to yourself, I should have gone to Boston?
No, and I say that, and everyone probably would say, no, you're not telling the truth. There was never a minute that once I made the decision to not go, and it was about a 24-hour period. It was a very, and like Stanford, you know, was probably the second toughest decision I'd ever had to make professionally in my life. But once I remember calling John Henry the next morning, because I was up all night, and the guy that I confided in that whole time was JP, who was still to this day one of my closest friends, and he was my right-hand guy at the time, and him and Paul. And I just knew it wasn't right. And I'm tough call talking to John Henry, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for. It was really one of the attractions was going to work for John Henry. But to call him the next morning and just say, listen, I can't take this job, was very difficult to do. But I knew as soon as I said it that I was doing the right thing because I felt better. But I always say this too, and I, and again, the other thing too is a lot of it was personal. I mean, I was 40 years old. My parents were 60. My daughter was 12 at the time. I wasn't planning on going and failing. I figured if I went to Boston, I was going to be there for 20 years. I didn't want to come back to California. My parents were 80, and my daughter was 30. It was very much a personal decision. That, and again, when I had signed out of high school to Stanford, I'd made a little bit of a financial decision, and I'd compromised as to what I really wanted to do, which was go to Stanford, then play professional baseball. I said I'd never do that again. And I realized that Boston's an amazing franchise, one of the greatest franchises in sports in the world. But it wasn't my dream to run the Red Sox, and so I realized I would have been making the decision for the wrong reason. I didn't want to be in a time zone 3 hours away from my entire life, personal life. And as I always said, it turned out they got the right guy. They got Theo Epstein, who brought him 2 world championships. He hired Ben Cherington, who brought him a world championship. And they've won another since then. So, again, the right guy ran that club, somebody who was a Brookline native, who had an intense love for the franchise, and things worked out well. And so that's the way I look at it. Again, to answer your original question is, I never for 1 minute ever look back. And things turned out great for me. I honestly would not change a thing from that point forward.
Late 90s, early 2000s, you brought up a bunch of really good players in the A's system. And then one by one, you watched each of them depart to go elsewhere. You traded some of them. Mm-hmm. Some left as free agents. Jason Giambi, Miguel Tejada, Johnny Damon, Tim Hudson, Mark Mulder. How frustrating was it for you to have that core of a team together and then have to watch them leave one by one?
Yeah, I'll tell you a moment. I remember sitting in 2000. First of all, we've had some really good teams, I think, since I've been here. The 2001 team was the best team I think I've ever had. I mean, it was unbelievable. And in fact, we got beat in game 5, and I remember sitting out waiting for the luggage. In fact, game 5 was in New York that year. I remember we get back really late in Oakland, and me and Paul were sitting out watching the luggage come off the charter at 4 in the morning or whenever we landed. And we're just kind of mumbling to each other, knowing that, this team's not going to be together. That we're going to lose most of these guys at the end of the season. As it turned out, we did. Johnny Damon was gone, Isringhausen was gone, Giambi gone, and they were all at the door. And knowing that, what a shame would have been, because I thought it was the best team in baseball that year, 2001. It was just an amazing team. And I remember the following year, I think it was one of the ESPN was doing one of the games or somebody, one of the games were televised, and they calculated the payroll that we would have needed to keep that team together, and it was like over $300 million. And I understand, this was like 2002.
Right.
That's a lot of money now, but imagine what it was like. So it tells you what the market thought of that team. And we still had Tejada still. We still had Zito. We still had Mulder. We still had Hudson. But just with the guys going out, if we had kept that team together. So that was a pretty special time here. When you think about, I was smart enough to realize, after my first year, we didn't have a particularly great year as a GM, but I remember sitting there thinking it was a 2000 when I had Hudson, Mulder, Zito. And I'm going, some GMs might not have one guy like that their whole career. I got 3 at the same time. And to go out and listen, any GM will tell you, the starting pitching will sort of determine your mood that day. And when you get to throw those guys out there, and understand during that time period too, we followed them up with some pretty good 4 and 5 guys, Ted Lilly, Corey Lytle, who were very, very good pitchers for us. And it was a pretty special group. And then with Giambi, you know, with first base, Tejada. I mean, Ramon Hernandez, a very good player. Eric Chavez. It was an incredible, incredible group of guys. But it was also the time that the game was changing. And, you know, we weren't able to keep those guys together. But if you look at a lot of those guys, how much longer they played after that. I mean, the Tejadas, the Giambis, the Hudsons, I mean, the Damons. It was, I mean, it shows you how great a team they were. We had them in their prime, too, at least for a year or two.
People forget how well Zito pitched in that game three against the Yankees. The flip play, obviously, is the thing everybody talks about. That was a great game.
Yeah, Mussina. It was Mussina and Barry.
That was his first year in New York.
Yeah, and you know what, people. Actually, you know, you watch that play and you still go, I don't know if out or save. But
depends
what
side you're on. Yeah. Eric Chavez, when he came to the Yankees, still insisted to that moment he was out. So
I think the thing that people assume is that had he been called safe, that we were going to win. Now, the one thing people forget that series, and this is the details that people forget, is that number one, I think that was like the seventh inning or something. And they still had Rivera, who had not pitched that series. So he could have gone multiple innings. So the idea that, you know, hey, we scored that run, we won the series, is probably, it's not the fact. We would have had still an uphill with a 1-1 game, and understand there was two outs, with a 1-1 game, we still had the back end with Rivera with at least two innings. And so it still would have been a very difficult game to win. But that was a great team. And, you know, listen, the team we lost to, I mean, that was, you know, I won't say the back end, but the 98 Yankees, since I've been involved in professional baseball, are the best team I've ever seen. And that was still that group of guys. And so, you know, a very good A's team lost to a historic team during that time period.
0-2, you have the big winning streak. The following year, Moneyball comes out. I would imagine that dramatically changed your life when that book came out. What was your initial reaction when the book came out?
Well, I was mad at Michael Lewis. Mainly because I was cursing like a sailor. This sounds crazy, but that was my first words to him, that I was mad that, you know, because I told you I came up with a military family, and I really said this. I said, my parents are going to kill me. you know, it was a little overwhelmed because, you know, there's always this assumption that we sort of incorporated Michael, each other, to write this book. We had no idea Michael was going to write the book. And he'll tell you, if you ever hear him talk about it, that it was very sneaky the way he embedded himself. I mean, first it was a newspaper article, then it was going to be a New York Times magazine piece. He kept drawing it out. But what we were guilty of is being intoxicated by a really smart guy, Paul and I. I mean, we liked hanging out with Michael. And, I mean, listen, we were right, because since then he's probably arguably one of the most influential nonfiction writers in the world today. And at the time, he understood what we were doing. You know, in fact, it was down here in Phoenix, and the first 2 minutes we sat down with him, he said, I know exactly what you guys are doing here in Oakland. And we kind of like, who's this guy, right? And he goes, you're arbitraging the mispricing of baseball players. And we kind of like, whoa. because in some sense, in a very crude way, you know, Paul and I were following what was going on Wall Street. You know, we were fascinated by, you know, Warren Buffett, obviously, and then what was going on with the quantitative hedge funds. And we had, you know, access to this Bill James information. We had access to, at that time, we had some proprietary analytics we were using. And so to be around a guy like Michael was really intoxicating, you know, because he understood what we were doing, and he was kind of validating what we were doing. And nobody really understood what we were doing. You know, a one-off, you know, all this, you know, numbers, this on-base percentage stuff. But ironically, what was written in the book wasn't the complete story. I mean, it was a lot of it, but there was other stuff we were using that Michael wasn't privy to, that is more common today. And but Michael was very smart in the way he sort of slowly, we gained our confidence. And then, you know, and honestly, it wasn't probably till the middle of the summer after the draft. He goes, you know, I'm going to write a book. And me and Paul were scared out of our minds because we literally had no idea what he was going to write. He went that whole offseason, and trust me, he didn't call us. We had no editorial control. And the first time we saw the book was almost a year after we met him. It was down here at spring training. He sends me and Paul a copy of The Galley. He said, hey, I'll let you guys read this, you know, let you read it before it comes out. But he said, understand, you know, you can't change a word in the book. So we both were just scared out of our minds. And honestly, we sort of both viewed it differently. You know, it was, again, I said, my parents are going to kill me. I'm cursing all through this book. And, you know, Paul had a different viewpoint of it. But the one thing, when it came out, The one thing I knew when I read it was I wasn't misquoted. You know, and, you know, as you know, where there's a lot of noise around it. And the one thing I wasn't going to do is say, listen, hey, I was misquoted in an effort to sort of, you know, it would have been the easy way out, which, right. But it wouldn't have been the truth. You know, and I always, you know, at the time, it's easier now to say, hey, I wasn't misquoted. You know, we're 15 years later and it's gone on to Michael's credit. It's, you know, one of the best selling baseball. I think it still is the best selling baseball book. And, you know, and but at the time, saying you weren't misquoted was a little gutsier than it is now.
Right.
You know, but I was determined to say, listen, I wasn't. And I, you know, to be honest with you, I believed what was in there. I believed ultimately what we're doing was going to be the way things were done. And so I was playing the long game.
Did you face any resentment from any of your peers in the years immediately after the book was released?
You know, it was certainly not face to face, you know. I wasn't overly worried about that, to be honest with you. I in some sense, what I think some of the concerns about the book, I knew was basically going to be BS. I mean, in fact, quite frankly, you know, for every person that might have been, you know, maybe upset or threatened by it, two people had opportunities. And I think that's sort of, I mean, the game of baseball now is a meritocracy. You know, playing the game gives you you don't necessarily, because you played the game, you get to run the team.
Right.
Because they're two different skill sets. And
matter of fact, it may almost hurt you at this point. Right, there's not many players out there.
Well, I mean, listen, yeah, I think you have to think of it differently. I mean, there's certain, you know, play gives you a certain different viewpoint that can be an advantage, but you know, again, you've got to combine it with other skills. And again, I think the great thing, that's a much more diverse game in terms of who's involved, who's running it. There's more jobs, ironically, because it's the age of information. And you know, in fact, I remember there was this, you know, the scouting staffs were going to be blown up. Guess what? There's twice as many scouts on our staff. You know why? Because there's information they can give us that we can't get from a hard drive. And again, driven by information. And you know, just like any industry, anytime there's something, there's a big change, there's a fear that, you know, certainly, I mean, everyone worries about their job, and that's natural. But usually an innovation will actually create a more efficient business, and in terms, it will grow and create more opportunities. I think that's what's happened.
When the book came out, you became a bit of a cult figure with Fortune 500 CEOs and a lot of people in the business world. Did that surprise you at all?
It was flattering. I mean, some of the letters I got, and it was humbling. When Paul and I would both kind of pinch ourselves with some of the letters and the phone calls, and because it wasn't we weren't trying to be. We were just trying to survive.
Right.
You know, we were with a low payroll. That was simple. It was simply our goal. It was humbling. I remember my longtime assistant in Oakland, who's still with me, Betty, comes into my office and she said, there's a gentleman named Newt on the phone. And I go, and he goes, his name is Newt Gingrich. And I go, you know, and this, I think at this time, might've been, I don't know if it was past the Speaker of the House days, but you know, he's certainly a prominent, you know, figure in, you know, American politics still. And you know, I remember just some of the correspondence I would get was really just, it was very, very, again, very humbling. And you know, that was just with the book. Because, I mean, the book, I mean, there was a Wall Street, there was a business crowd that read it, you know, business schools were using it. When the movie came out, a different thing. I mean, that sort of exposed it to everybody, and not just people here in the States, but all over the world as well. That was, you know, the phone calls you got on that was even, you know, even broader, and that was, again, humbling.
Was it more flattering or frustrating for you to see so many other teams adopt a lot of the philosophies from the book?
Well, we knew what was going to happen. I guess flattering would, you know, in some sense it forced us to continue to have to sort of innovate and, you know, try new things. We knew it was, I mean, listen, the game was becoming smarter. You know, there, you know, instead of just one Paul here in Oakland, Dee Podesta with me, then there, you know, you got guys like, you know, Theo coming in the game. Listen, the guy who doesn't get any credit is Brian Cashman. You know, I mean, the foolish thing I said with Brian was when he was looking to start an analytics department, if I had any recommendations for him, and ultimately I gave a recommendation, and the young man's his right-hand guy there right now, Michael Fishman. So when you had really smart guys like Brian and Theo who not only are bright, but they also have capital. That's a formidable opponent. And we still face that today. And so, but again, I think it was the natural, it was going to happen. And so I wasn't surprised. I guess flattery is probably the word I would use.
Were rival executives wary of dealing with you after the book, thinking like, well, if he likes this player, what am I missing about that player? Did you feel any of that?
That happened in one or two instances, but though I think those people weren't you know in the job very long after that. I mean, the you know, listen, there was a time when there was a segment of GMs who viewed the world, say, like we did, and then there were some that viewed it differently. So you had a natural trade partner. Some of those GMs on the side were very good GMs, and so they were self-confident what they were doing, and you know, a lot of them were very successful. And what happened over time, though, is that, you know, ultimately analytics and objective decision making has been a part of almost every team in some respect. I mean, you're not going to call a GM and they're going to have absolutely no idea how to evaluate their own players. It just doesn't happen now. I mean, every GM in this game today has got a pretty good idea of what they have and what you have, which is why transactions, trades are more difficult now than they were before, because a lot of us do view the game. It just depends. The key to a transaction now is where you are in terms of your team's development. Are you looking for younger players, or are you looking for established guys? But as far as, you know, trying to like get a guy that the other side thinks is not very good, and actually that doesn't happen anymore.
All right, last Moneyball question. We have a lot more of your career to get to. Last year, you said that rereading the book, quote, is like watching an episode of The Flintstones. How has the game and your approach to it changed the most in the past 16 years?
Well, it's true. The longer you do a job, you become more humble. And I've talked to Brian Cashman about this. If you think about it, if you do this job for 20 years, what ends up happening is people only remember all the mistakes you made, you know? And if you've done it for 20 years, you probably made some decisions you might not do again.
Sure.
And so, it humbles you, but it also, it gives you a sense, you know you're not infallible, but I think there's a certain peace that comes with that, and it makes it easier to make decisions, realize, and it also puts the people around you at ease. There's never been an environment here in Oakland, at least we've not tried not to create, where you better be right in your decision. In fact, all of us have been together so long that we joke about all the mistakes we've made. You know, whether it be me trading Josh Donaldson, or us not drafting Mike Trout, you know, things like all these things. I mean, 20 years, I could put you a Hall of Fame team together that we had a shot at, and it humbles you, and you realize that, you know, you're not always going to be right. The other guy on the other side is not always dumb. And again, over time, there's a sense of comfort in knowing you're not going to be right every time, and so you take the pressure off of being right every time, and I think it helps you make decisions. The other thing too is I've realized, I mean, I have driven to the park a lot of, I mean, 20 plus years with 162 games a year, that's a lot of drives into the stadium when you have a game. And I know when the team's going really well, that I start thinking in my head, well, at some point it's going to turn, or it's not going to be good. And when things are really bad, it's going to turn the other way. You stay very balanced. And I mean, you care just as much about winning and losing, but I think you also have a little bit of perspective and understand again that we're not machines. We're going to make mistakes, and it's how you sort of respond to those mistakes is really how successful you are going forward.
In 2005, you were given an extension, and part of that, you received a small ownership stake in the team. Not a very common thing for a front office executive to get. What did that mean to you?
You know, I think part of it was, I think from a business standpoint, you wanted to be a part of the value creation a little bit. In fact, I was willing to give up salary to be a part of that because I felt like, listen, if I made good decisions and my owner had 95% of the team and I had 5% of the team, that he would benefit from those. The 95% would benefit exponentially relative to my 5%, but my 5% would also be a great benefit to me. And again, it was sort of betting on myself. And it was one of the smartest business decisions ever made, I can assure you, because certainly it's been a time of growth in this game, and I've been fortunate. It goes back a little bit to, you know, reading everything that Warren Buffett ever wrote about, you know, businesses. You know, quite frankly, if I owned my own sports team, whether it be a whatever team, football, baseball, soccer, I would want the guy who was making those decisions to have some skin in the game and be a part of that growth as well. I would want my own employee to have ownership of my business, mainly because I know if he owns part of it, he's going to make decisions for the long haul, and he's going to make decisions based over the next 20 years, 25 years, not over the next 2 or 3 years or during his contract.
October 2015, you're promoted to Executive Vice President of Baseball Operations. David Force was promoted to GM. What's the dynamic between the two of you when it comes to decision-making?
Well, first of all, David is, I hate to use this term, but it maybe tells you the personal fondness I have for him, is that he's like a brother to me. But he's a brother who's been incredibly instrumental in my career. He's been my right hand. He's the one guy. He's the constant. You know, this is his 20th year with me. I think maybe 2000 was his first year. So he missed the 98-99 season. But beyond that, literally every day, 4 to 5 times a day, I've spoken to this man. And so any decision that we've made, whether it be good or bad, and I like to think that a lot of them has been good. David's been a part of it. He's been my consigliere, my right-hand guy, and to some extent, mine his too. I mean, because we have a very flat structure, even though the media guide may say, me on top, David here, and everyone else. Once we get into this office, it's very flat. We allow a lot of autonomy, and there's no hierarchy here. I interact with my analyst. David does the same thing. But having a guy like David for me, I mean, literally to know that when you say one thing, you only have to say it one time, and it's going to get done exponentially too, far beyond what you ever asked for. And he's an incredibly talented executive, one of the closest friends in life, along with having a moral compass that is as good as anybody you'll ever want to be next to. So just a very important part of my life, and not just professionally, but personally.
You've had a reputation of getting aggressive in the summer if you see a chance to contend with your team. Last year alone, Familia, Sean Kelly, Fernando Rodney, Mike Fiers. Do you think a front office owes it to players, to fans, when there is that opportunity to go for it?
Absolutely. And in fact, if you don't, when you have that opportunity, you're in the wrong job. That's why we get these jobs, to do those deals. And, you know, and there will never be a day that I don't get excited about making those deals in that time of year. And I remember that, you know, it's funny, we were talking about David, when we did the Familia deal, I was actually up in the middle of nowhere in Canada fishing, right? And it was a little before the trade deadline, so I have been fishing on the deadline, but I've done a deal on a river, but I remember I was literally in this, in Vancouver Island, in the middle of nowhere, and once I left that morning to go, we were taking a plane up to go to fishing. I was going to have no contact. So JP was on the other end of that with Matt's, my old friend.
Right.
And we completed the deal conceptually, but we hadn't done the medical. And I had to get out to go to this fishing. And this is where David, we got the Familia deal done. I'm not going to be back in contact till like 8 o'clock tonight when we get back from this fishing trip. And but we had to do medical. And I think at that time we were trying to get a hold of my owner too, to get the okay, and which we felt fine about. But so literally that whole day goes by, so I go fishing the whole day. And as soon as I get, the only place there was Wi-Fi in this entire place was right in my little room that I was staying in, this lodge. And as soon as I get into my room, all these emails come flooding through. And I had no idea if this trade, it turned out it was complete. But that was, you know, those are stories. We all have stories. I mean, the trade deadline, I could tell you almost every trade deadline and tell you about that exact trade.
Now that all 30 teams have kind of caught up to most extent on analytics, do you think sports science might be the next area where teams really look to get that next competitive advantage?
I think the foundation for any advantage going forward is going to be data-driven. I think there's two things. I think you have biomechanics, or the biomedical field, and I think ultimately that as it relates to injuries. I think health is probably the one, is the black box that nobody's sort of broken into in sports. A lot of it is because the solutions are going to be data driven, and let's face it, there's going to be privacy issues when it comes to health. So it's a little bit of there's a gap between the data and privacy. But I think that any sports team, not just the baseball team, the one that, and you're never going to solve the health issue. But if you can sort of reduce, say, a time a guy spends on the DL, if you can sort of predict injuries, I mean, just take in baseball, Tommy John, the probably billions of dollars that are lost by virtue of players who have that injury. And I think, again, I think that we're all looking to be better at keeping players in the field, because if you look at any sport, the team that's successful usually is the healthiest team, and you'd be surprised at how the correlation between health and success. I mean, you take the New England Patriots; they've only not made the playoffs 1 year since Brady and Belichick. But then it was a year Brady got hurt.
And they still won 11 games.
They still did. Yeah, it was, you know, only the Patriots could take Matt Castle,
right,
have him, you know, perform unbelievably, and then trade him for a truckload of draft choices. You know, perfect Patriot transaction, right? But again, you know, it goes back. It was health, you know. And if you, I think I saw a New York Times article years ago that the playoff teams in the NFL are the healthiest teams, and you would expect that in the NFL because it's such a physical sport. But the same is true in baseball. I know we've had teams that I knew that if they'd stayed healthy were capable of winning, but they didn't, and therefore they didn't win.
You've said rather than rebuilding, you'd like to reshuffle. Given that, and given the financial limitations in certain aspects, how much pride do you take? You've been to the playoffs 9 times in your 21 years here.
Yeah, we missed by one game in 04. That one still hurts. We had a one-game lead going with 3 games at home against the Angels, and we lost the division that year, and we lost by one. So that would have been, like I said, it still hurts as much as anything. I'm very proud of that. And listen, you know, you know, you talk about we've had players we drafted, but I think that 12, 13, 14, and 12 is another year. Going into that season, you talk about, I think one of the, you know, famous websites had us as the 30th ranked team in baseball. In fact, I think the quote was, we could lose up to 110 games a year. And we won the division in 2012, and then we won it 2 more years. And so what I was most proud about that era, and even the one we have now, but that 12, 13, 14, that every one of those players except one, basically, especially the 12, were players we traded for. Those were all transactions. And we weren't waiting for the draft. In fact, the one guy I think Sonny Gray was the one guy who came up in 12 that was the player we drafted. Every other player on that team was a player that we traded for. And, you know, to me, that's like, that's a credit to, you know, the evaluation process up and down. It wasn't just waiting 5 years for a bunch of high draft choices. So each team was built differently, and that team was a transaction-based team. The Hudson, Mulder, Zito, that was very much a drafted and an organizational developed team. The most recent team we had this last year was a little bit of a combination of both. There's some small transactions, and then merging them with some very, you know, smart drafts, Matt Olson, Matt Chapman, Chad Pender, guys like that who were blended in with the Chris Davises and the Jed Lowrys and the Marcus Simeons who were traded. So this was a combination. But each playoff team we've had has been, it really hasn't been one that's been an extended group of players or extended length of time of one player. They've all been their own story, which is us, I think, doing our job.
Just a few left here. When Kyler Murray declared his intention to play football instead of baseball, you were quoted as saying, if I can get do-overs, can I maybe invest in Apple stock 30 years ago as my first choice? I don't get do-overs. How tough is it to have that type of situation, especially for a club like yours that does rely on the draft to import, yeah, you know, big-time talent?
Well, listen, it's still an it's not a finished story. You know, I mean, I guess the way I look at it is that we hold Kyler Murray's draft rights. He can't play for any other baseball team except ours. Now, this is a pretty special athlete, as we've all come to realize. And I don't think anybody going into the football season, I think we all knew he's a talented football player, but I don't think anybody, including the NFL, maybe even including the University of Oklahoma or Oklahoma University, thought that he was going to do what he did. That's a credit to the kid. But listen, we're sitting here now. It's a story that isn't finished. He may go on to a great NFL career. If for some reason he does not and he plays baseball, well, guess what? The team that gets to have him is us. So that's we'll look at the glass half full at this point.
You famously don't like watching your team play, citing the desire not to get emotional. Yeah. Do you ever go watch games later on? How about postseason? Can you watch postseason games?
Postseason, I will watch.
Okay.
Yes, I will watch postseason. At that point, it's basically a one-off.
Right.
So I actually enjoy them. You know, But the season's still hard for me to watch. And a lot of it is that, you know, I was kind of, listen, I don't, you know, gyrating in your seat on May 15th and game number 33, some little micro event that's going to have no impact, unless it's an injury, is going to have no impact on the end of the season. And I don't really want to make a decision based on the micro event. Why do I want to sit through 3 hours, 162 nights, and be a miserable person to be around for my family? So it's a way of sort of governing my emotions. Hopefully making better decisions once the results are in. And I've sort of learned that I'm a much better decision making when I'm not sort of subject to the event going on, that when it's over and I can look at it, then I'll you know, one of my rules now, when Bob first came in, and I learned this over time, you know, when I was a young GM, listen, after the game, I was usually in there with the manager and you know, expressing my, you know, happiness or unhappiness at what happened on the field that night. And I realized it's not a necessarily a great thing to do. And so, you know, and it's been a long time, but my rule with the manager and even with Bob when he first came over, I said, listen, I won't, after the game, night game, I won't even, we talk the next day. Unless there's an injury, we need to do something. I said, day games, I'll come in there, we'll chat. But I said, as a rule, if you're on the road, if we're playing the Yankees, I'm going to be in bed by the time the game's over, just so you know. And I said, unless, again, we have a transaction, let's speak in the morning. Because 75% of what we would say after a game, either one of us, is probably not something we'd say in the morning. And I learned that, you know, because I realized that this is such, every night, you know, manager doesn't need me wearing him out. We don't need to be going back and forth. And we're both going to make better decisions and have better evaluations when we have a clear head and the emotion of the game's over.
Do you watch the highlights the next day? I mean, you missed some pretty good baseball last year.
Yeah. When it's over, then I can go back.
Right.
You know? And so,
just in the moment.
Yeah. Exactly. And a part of it is just, again, I think I'm a much better. I can't turn off the intensity while it's going on, and that's a way of you know, keeping it in check.
Farhan once said that the people who have worked for you want to see you win a World Series more than you want it for yourself. What would it mean for you in your career? Is it going to be a hole in your career if you don't get that championship?
You know, when I answer this, when I truly believe, no one believes me. You know, I feel like I should, okay, well, you know, I should have. I never really thought about that. And I mean that. Again, the reason it would be important for me is for the people who work around me, for the city, and I honestly mean that. Even the term legacy when it comes to something professionally is not something I embrace. I always said, my legacy is my kids. After that, you know, this has been a great way to make a living. And I've been able to, you know, do things that to have my hobby pay me at the level they pay me is just an incredible opportunity that most people in this world don't have. So, but the idea that my professional career would need to be validated, you know, whether the world's, I've never viewed it that way. I mean, but again, I whenever I say that, I'm going, I'm showing, oh yeah, sure, but that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Last one, a couple years ago, you said, as long as I find the job exciting and rewarding, I'll want to do it. How long can you see yourself? How long do you want to do this job?
I'm at least at the point now where I ask myself that question. I still love the job. I mean, I'm blessed to get to do this job, come to Arizona for spring training and work and live in California my whole life, which I love. But I think what keeps me going now is the people I work with. I love, the idea that I would come to the office or not come to the office and get to see David every day, get to see Dan Feinstein, get to see Bob Melvin, get to see Stu Vucinich, longtime clubhouse guys. That's what I still love about the game, and I'm blessed that I've been around these people in some cases for 30 plus years, and to get to work in this business, to get to choose. You know, at the point now, that was the best advice Sandy Alderson gave me. He said, you know, early in my career, I had that opportunity to leave and go somewhere else, and Sandy said, well, you're not ready. You know, I was very young, and he said, you're not ready. When you become a general manager, you want ultimately to do the job as long as you want the job. Not to just get the job and be done in 3 years. And that's happened to people over the years. And I'd like to think that in taking his advice, I at least reached the point in my life that you can ask the question, how long do you want to do it? And I think that in some sense, it's satisfying to know that at least you've reached a level of success that I can actually answer that question. And to answer your question, I'm not sure, but I still love doing it now.
Billy, thanks so much for your time. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Mark.
Many thanks to Billy Bean for taking the time to sit down for this week's episode of Executive Access. Coming up in future episodes this season, I'll sit down with Giants senior advisor J.P. Ricciardi, Red Sox assistant general manager Zach Scott, and many more executives around the league. You can search for Executive Access on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Art19, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. So be sure to subscribe and enjoy these conversations all season long. If you like what you hear, leave us a review while you're at it. We always appreciate those. And be sure to spread the word and tell all the baseball fans in your life about Executive Access. Until next time, I'm Mark Feinsend.